Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon, and this is what's known as an early drop in podcasting lingo. It just means it's out a day early. The reason is, later on I'm going to be previewing the Champion of Champions, and I wanted to do that in good time, because obviously it starts Monday, so I want to give people a chance to listen to, for what they're worth, my thoughts on the tournament and the matches. Because there's still one place to be decided, potentially in the International Championship final. Ding Junhui in at the moment, obviously waiting on results. And as I record this, I don't know who's won the tournament, obviously, because it's not over yet. But it's been a very interesting week of snooker. The crowds have been fantastic. It's a new city, Tianjin, for snooker. First big international event there. You're never quite sure how it will go. It's gone brilliantly. Real good atmosphere and nice to have, you know, that support. And I did predict on day one there'd be a lot of centuries. The pockets certainly played generously early on. The tables, they did change a little bit, I think, as the week went on. And certainly sort of by the quarterfinals, it seemed that they weren't quite so generous. But then, of course, they were reclothed for the semifinals. The standard's been high, but the players are really good. You must always remember that when people sort of talk about these things. The players are really good. And that obviously helps the standard. So we'll have a Champion of Champions preview coming up. But first of all, a couple of emails from last week just came in under the, or I suppose over the wire, because I'd already recorded. So our dear friend Alpha Bonzi and also David Burney. Now, David Burney has been to Brazil, so we have a first-hand dispatch here from David. Of course, Canadian, but he's been at the Pan American Championship. He says it looked like we're going to have another Brazilian player on the tour. This is played just recently, and it was Jonas Lutz. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but Jonas Lutz. He beat Fabinho 5-4 to win in Rio de Janeiro. And David was there. He said Jonas was able to grab a 2-year card as the winner of the Pan American Championship. In addition, fellow countryman Igor Figueiredo will be playing at the Crucible Theatre this May at the World Seniors Championship as he won the Pan American Seniors event. There's something going on in the Amazon. There are some strong Brazilians playing down there. As well, 13-year-old Eduardo Henrique Faria made a nice debut by winning one of his games. The future looks bright south of the equator. Well, just on that, of course, years ago, Steve Davis went out to play Rui Chapo, who died a couple of years ago. And he was the great Brazilian snooker player. They're playing on smaller tables out there. I think 10 reds and a smaller table. And He wore a hat, and he said he would only remove it when he got beat. I think he did lose to Steve, actually, but he kept the hat on. Anyway, I may have that the wrong way around. He definitely wore the hat. He played in the World Masters in Birmingham, 1991. Rui Chapo. Igor Figueiredo had a terrific talent, but I think he couldn't make it pay, coming over, you know, trying to play on the circuit, coming over from Brazil. Which is a shame, because he was great to watch. Anyway, David continues. The entire CBBS team was wonderful. They made myself and everyone from out of town feel right at home in Rio. They had six tables going, and was able to have referees at all tables all tournament long. As well, great people making sure all the stats were updated so people could see where their favourite player was and how the tournament was shaping up. Also, Antonio was a wonderful streaming producer. His English isn't perfect, but neither is my Portuguese. Daniel and Januaro did a great job commentating the whole event in Portuguese. My new brother's behind the mic. Snooker's growing in the Americas, and it's great to see. This is all positive stuff, David. He said, up in Canada, we're just finishing up another BC Open qualifier. And as I write this, the tournament hasn't concluded, but I wanted to mention the young 9-year-old, Hiren Dasani, got his first ever match win. Impressive. He's fearless. He goes for a lot of pots and makes his good share of them. He knows a little about the tactical side. That's only going to get stronger as he continues to progress in the game. Well, he's got a lot of time to do that if he's 9. I mean, we had a 12-year-old, of course, playing Judd Trump in the International Championship. So they start in early these days. But good to know what's happening down there in South America. And, of course, they play snooker. You must remember this. We talk a lot about the professional game. But snooker's played all around the world in amateur levels and different levels. And it's great to see, you know, the competitiveness and the enthusiasm that people have. Now, for Bonzi, you've written in with some UK Championship memories. Now, this was me asking for these, and I'm going to address these, Alpha, closer to the UK Championship. So people should keep them coming in. If you've got any great memories of that tournament, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. But he asked a question here, aside from that. He said, do I and other snooker fans like me take the sport too seriously, considering I have no connection to anyone in the game? Should I, being solely a fan, stick to matters on the table rather than getting bogged down with various off-table issues like the poorly planned calendar, match fixing scandals, live scoring issues, etc.? Well, and he also said, before I answer that, he also says he sends his best wishes to one of our correspondents, John, who was talking about some tough times that he had he took his focus off snooker. That's very kind of Alpha. I mean, do you take it too seriously? You take it as seriously as you want to take it, I suppose. You take an interest in whatever you like and give your views on whatever you like. The only thing I would say is I think sometimes people do get the wrong end of the stick with things if they don't have first-hand knowledge of it. And the problem these days is it's very easy to, you know, go online and say everything's an outrage when you don't really know any of the facts. And, you know, that does happen quite a lot. So, but, I mean, it's good that I think people take an interest in different areas of the game. Just remember, though, that I guess it's not always kind of as black and white as people. A lot of the issues are not always as black and white as people would have you believe. Now, he asks another question here. He says, suggestion for a future podcast, but I will read it now. It says, players who've reached one major, not the shootout ranking final, without winning, i.e. Gary Wilkinson at the 1991 British Open, and players have won major invitationals without winning the rankers, i.e. Wilkinson in the 1991 World Match Play. So this isn't niche. This is players who've won a big invitation event, reached a ranking final, but not won it. One ranking final. The other one I could think of, and it's quite a sort of relevant one actually, Alpha, because he passed away this year, Perry Mans, of course, got to the World Championship final, and then won the Masters. So, you know, he would certainly qualify, I think, under your criteria there. But we may revisit that in the future. You may be able to tell that I've got something of a sort of sore throat. And on this subject, seamless segue here, I've had an email from Stephen Michelle in Glasgow. They say, it feels like a lifetime ago. Stephen's writing this. It feels like a lifetime ago since Michelle and I accosted you a photo in The Graduate following an incredible evening session between Luca Brasel and CJ Wee at the Crucible back in April. Thank you again for being so accommodating with your time as we lurk behind a pillar waiting for the opportune moment. What can we say? We're easily starstruck. Yes, I think that's certainly true. I mean, yes, The Graduate, I mean, to be fair, it was 50-50 whether I was going to be in there or not, and I was. So it was nice to meet you. Very nice to meet you. Since we have not one, not two, but three questions for you. Firstly, we've been closely following the results of Brasel and CJ Wee ever since the Worlds and expected better form and consistency from both. But we appreciate that's easier said than done. Did you have any expectations or predictions for either player following their respective World Championship performances? Well, I'll answer these in turn. Expectations, it's difficult, I think, because every sort of world champion, I suppose, comes to it in a different way. I mean, when Judd Trump won it, there was a kind of expectation that he would win it, and of course he was winning a lot of other tournaments. So you sort of thought that, you know, he was used to winning by then. He would carry on, and he did. Whereas Bissell, he'd only won, I think, three other tournaments before. So, you know, he wasn't that regular a winner. What I thought for this season was, I thought he would come good probably now and again, maybe win a couple of tournaments. I didn't expect him to dominate. What's actually happened is he's still on a high from winning the World Championship in terms of off the table. He's enjoying his life, and there's nothing wrong with that. Been doing a lot of travelling and just enjoying things. He looked rusty in Tianjin at the International Championship. And, you know, there was a lot of sort of almost celebrated a bit too much, I think, all this business, oh, I haven't practiced for the World Championship. He does need matches. He needs to practice. He needs sharpness, because everyone else is sharp, or a lot of them are. And he's lost a few paces maybe against the rivals. So the Champion of Champions, we'll talk about his group later. That could be an opportunity, you know, to maybe start to perform this season. Of course, he did get to the Shanghai Masters final. But my expectation was, I didn't feel he would be overly burdened by being world champion. It's not that so far. It's more that he just isn't playing very much, I think. Si Jiawei, it was difficult to know how he would take that defeat. Everyone said about his age, I was only 20, he'll get over it. But it was tough to take. He must have thought several times in the months since, I could have been in the World Championship final. He's not had a terrible season, but he's not really done anything dramatic. He's not sort of got to latter stages of tournaments. I think there's still time. I hope he does. He's a very entertaining, talented player to watch, but it's hard, is the problem. And also, I think when you do well, I know he didn't win it, but when you have a bit of profile and go deep in the biggest tournament in terms of the World Championship, the semi-finals, other players raise their game against you. Jack Jones, I think, has found this as well. You know, that you suddenly become someone that people are really focused to try and beat. Plenty of snooker left to play, though, this season, so we'll follow their progress with interest. Now then, Stephen and Michelle's second question. Michelle and I are both afflicted with a stubborn virus at the moment, of which the latest stage is a sore throat and relentless cough. You piqued our interest in the last episode when you mentioned your throat was a little sore. It got us wondering if you take any particular precautions to protect your throat and vocal cords, much like professional singers or other broadcasters would. We wouldn't be surprised to learn there are some rather creative and legal home remedies being taken to preserve one's dulcet tones during the long season of commentary and various media duties, or as much as one can protect their immune system when travelling the world and being amongst people most of the time. Have you made any special provisions throughout your broadcasting career, or do you know of any other snooker commentators or pundits who do? Not really, I would say. I mean, I've had a cold. I mean, big deal, really, and a lot of it about in the winter. I've never been in a position where I can't sort of, I can't speak at all, touch wood. Clive Everton at the Crucible, because he did a lot of commentary and also reporting for BBC Radio, and he would always drink, before a broadcast, lime cordial. That was his drink. Now, I'm not a doctor, and neither's Clive. I don't know specifically why that would be the drink to have, but he would have sales of lime cordial in Sheffield every year skyrocketed for the 17 days, and he got to the stage where, because in those days, to get a drink in the little bar in the press room, there would be hospitality women would serve you, and if they saw Clive coming towards them, they would already be pouring lime cordial because they knew that's what he wanted. All I'll say is he never missed a commentary. Well, actually he did in the end, because he fell over in the hotel, but that's nothing to do with his throat. His throat always held up, so there may be something in that. My problem is I don't like lime cordial, so so I might have to look for something different. And the final question from Stephen and Michelle. VAR controversies continue to dominate the footballing world. A recent example would be post-match press conference and an extraordinary rant from Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta after his side lost at Newcastle to a controversial goal, reviewed by VAR at length, with Arteta fuming at the disgraceful situation. That was disgraceful in his words, by the way. So if relating this back to snooker, do any post-match conferences spring to mind for you, where a player's launched a scathing verbal tirade on a referee, or perhaps a heavy dose of passive-aggressive sarcasm? We can recall several incidents over the years during frames, but not so much during press conferences. With your Access All Areas press accreditation and overall snooker legend status, we expect you must have witnessed some humdingers of post-match presses. Well, I mean, funnily enough, it hasn't happened that often. I think sometimes players have certain views on referees, but they don't broadcast them. There is a sort of a genuine respect there for the job. And also, I think certainly the top referees, they do have respect because they can do the job well. The one that springs to mind was the Shanghai Masters final 2011. Mark Selby, Mark Williams, where Selby's played that, he snookered, he's played that sort of hit and hope, and it wasn't clear whether it was red or pink that he hit immediately, and then the replay came on in the arena and took a long time working it out. Irene Williams, who was a first-class referee, you know, referee World Finals, was unlucky. He was sort of caught in the crossfire of that. And Mark Williams, of course, he lost. He was 9-7, not lost 10-9. And he had a few things to say at the time, which were not that friendly, but just a reaction to losing. So that's one that stood out. But I think the referee was kind of innocent then. Obviously, and it wasn't a press conference, but the Ronnie O'Sullivan, Olivia Martile showdown, which of course will be part of this new O'Sullivan film that's out in a couple of weeks. That was pretty high profile. But to answer your question, not really. No, there haven't been that many. I mean, Alex Higgins used to slate referees on a regular basis, but it was so regular that no one really took any notice, because it was just pretty much every match towards the end that he said the referee wasn't up to it. I think, in general, if players have got an issue with the referees, they tend to now, they would more likely go to the tournament office and discuss it with the tournament director rather than sort of broadcast it in the media. And it's a good thing, I think, in snooker that the officials, by and large, you know, have the respect of the players. That's good, isn't it? Because it's certainly not the case in every sport. Now, James Heat. All I like about James is there's no rigmarole, there's no sort of a preamble. He just straight into the question. Not even a hello. He says, how are commentary pairings decided and who decides who is with who? For example, in a typical Eurosport tournament, on one day you're paired with Neil Folds and Philip Studd is paired with Joe Johnson. But on the next day, you might be commentating with Joe Johnson and Philip is with Neil. Similarly, on ITV4, you and Phil Yates will be commentating with different former players each day. Is there a deliberate policy to mix things up? I do notice, however, that in the two-session final on Eurosport, you are normally commentating on the final session. So when they play montages of the final moments of tournaments from years gone by, your voice is heard most of the time. Well, who decides, James? Well, the editor, the executive producer, the person in charge will usually do the rota. I think, I mean, you know, we do what we're told, obviously, but I think in general they do like to, yeah, mix the voices around so that it's not just the same people together all the time, so that there is a mix and it's different for the viewers. I don't know, you know, I don't know the extent of, you know, how much sort of time is spent thinking too much about it. I think if you've got a team that you respect, you don't need to sort of, you know, think about it too much, because hopefully all the voices are ones you want to be working for you. So in a way, it doesn't really matter that much who's together. But that's essentially it. The person who's running the production will decide who commentates with who. And I think most people would agree it's good to, you know, to have a variety of partnerships, because everyone works differently. And obviously some prefer certain partnerships to others. That's just natural. But to answer your question, that it's the editor of the, you know, the executive producer, the number one person who's in charge for the production will do the rotas. And in terms of finals, well, I've been very fortunate to comment out on a lot of, you know, very thrilling and hopefully, you know, sort of significant moments. But it raised an interesting point there about doing the end of finals, because on Eurosport, the finals often get repeated, very often. I mean, the World Championship final, the highlights of that will probably be shown possibly up to 20 times from when Luca Brasil won it to next year's World Championship, Christmas Day and various times. So that is one time when you really have to concentrate on what you're saying, think about what you're saying, because you know it's going to be replayed. So if you mess it up live, it's going to be messed up every time it's shown. So that is a time when you have to really think carefully about how you want the moment to be remembered, because like you say, it could be shown for years to come. So you want to feel that you got it right at the time. It's not for me to say whether I do or not, but that's the hope when you're there, that you try and capture the moment. And quite often as well, certainly the World Championship, what you say will be sort of lifted and taken and used in various VTs and features, you know, for the next year. So that's not something, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not saying it's more important than what the BBC do, but they obviously, they don't repeat the final. You won't see that
shown again. It'll be available, I'm sure, online, iPlayer, whatever. But Eurosport actually will repeat that highlights package of the final many times. So it's you're under a bit of pressure to get it right, I think.
Brian McGovern is asking, he says, were there only two tables available on Discovery Plus when there are eight tables in play at the same time? This is the International Championship. I'm sending this email during the O'Sullivan-Page match, where I'd like to pop in on the Trump-McGuire match. He says, I love the podcast. Keep it the good work. Yourself and Folds in the Dream Commentary team. Thank you, Brian. He's from Navan in the Republic of Ireland. I can only assume in China there's just a different contract, because I think this was the case in Wuhan as well. There are only two streaming tables. It's four in the UK. So I suspect it's a contractual thing. But you raise a very good point there, an important point, which is the situation with Judd Trump and Stephen Maguire. He was actually... Ronnie was playing Jack Jones, wasn't he? I think you said Jackson Page. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And Ding was on table two in the evening session. But Judd Trump didn't have to play in the evening session. He could have played in the afternoon. What has been the story of the last month in snooker? It's been Judd Trump winning three tournaments in a row, 22 ranking event matches in a row going into that match. Okay, a big story, a lot of interest in whether it will continue or whether it will end. He's playing Stephen Maguire, who's a big hitter, six-time ranking event winner. They played at Belfast in the quarterfinals. It was a great match. Trump was 3-1 down, won 5-4. How on earth is that match not on a television table? In the evening, Ronnie and Ding are on those tables. Understandably, Ronnie the biggest name in the sport, Ding the biggest name in China. You can understand that. But Judd Trump could have played in the afternoon. How on earth is Jack Nazowski against Anthony McGill a better choice for television than that match at this time? I mean, Trump Maguire a year ago would have been a terrific match, but all the focus and interest was on whether he could keep that run going. Instead, he's on table three. It was streamed in China. I know people have access to streams in other ways, but he's not officially available anywhere else in the world. So consequently, this quite historic sort of run that he was on, significant run certainly, came to an end like a damp squib. We didn't see the match. World Snooker Tour couldn't even put highlights of the match and monetize those highlights on YouTube because they had no footage that they could use on there. Now, I assume maybe the local promoter wanted Trump on at night to sell more tickets, but I asked World Snooker Tour and they said that was not the reason. The reason was that they and the local broadcaster, that's how they decided it. But I think it was a missed opportunity and quite a serious one, actually. You know, that was the story for the last month, Judd Trump's run, and he ended up losing on an outside table. Now, I'm not saying the reason he lost was because he was on an outside table. The run was always going to end at some point. Steve Maguire's been in good form. So had they been on table one, it may well have been the same. But that match could have been on television in the afternoon. And the thing is, World Snooker Tour spend a lot of money on various sort of promotional ideas, and good for them. They should be. No problem with that. But this didn't cost any money to put... All you're doing is just a schedule of play. Wouldn't have cost a penny to put Trump on table one in the afternoon, and win or lose, people would have been able to watch the match. It's not quite an answer to the question you asked, but I think that was a missed opportunity. One of the most important things is to get the right matches on tables where people can watch them. And as I say, that great run that he was on ended in a bit of obscurity, which is not great, really. By the way, it goes to something I was saying a couple of weeks ago about the lack of a sort of independent journalistic presence at many tournaments. You know, 20 years ago, I mean, we used to go to China, people like myself and Phil Yates, and had this happened then, you know, this sort of same scenario, the first thing we would have done is brought Judd Trump in for an interview and asked him what he thought of being on table three. As far as I'm aware, no one asked him. He may not have said anything. He may have played it down because some players like to do that. Or he may have had a bit of a go. But, you know, we don't have that now. We don't have that opportunity if journalists are not at tournaments. He may say something next week, I don't know. But anyway, I think it was unfortunate, let's put it that way, that was sort of squandered, that opportunity for more publicity by actually allowing people to see that match. Because unless you're at the venue or watching on... I know people were watching on a stream, but I mean, it wasn't an official one. So it was kind of hidden away, which I think is a shame. Now, Lawrence Carpenter, he says, I'm loving the podcast and your commentary as always. Thank you, Lawrence. He says, I was wondering if you'd heard Stephen Hendry's suggestion on the WST podcast about running one of the tournaments with the rule that playing for snookers isn't allowed, so that a frame finishes when it's mathematically over. His reasoning is that playing for snookers often drags play out when there's only a small chance of someone getting them and winning the frame, although obviously it does happen. What do you think? Clearly there is skill in forcing snookers, but personally, I'm always willing a player to pop the next ball or two after the snooker's required stage is reached, so the other player won't come back to the table, and we can avoid 10 or 15 minutes of the balls being tapped around with generally nothing gained. Just my opinion, but I'd be in favour as it would keep the game moving along. Yeah, I mean, I won't lie, I'm the same sometimes, not always, but sometimes you think, you just know the other player's not going to get the snookers and it does feel like sort of dead time. But I think you've got to be very careful, you know, sort of trying to change things and taking away what is a big skill level. And also, okay, the player may not get the snookers, but why should one player just be handed a frame? This just seems to be about making it easier for people. And it's not supposed to be easy. Snooker's supposed to be hard. And there are sort of, you know, things to think about. Say the player pots, okay, frame ball. So let's say they pot, I don't know, a colour that is frame ball. But they, in potting it, they snook themselves on the last red, okay? So mathematically they've won the frame, but they're now in a snooker of their own making. Does the frame just stop there? So the frame stops there, or do they have to get out of that snooker? How does it work? There'd be so many things that, like suggestions like this, people haven't really thought through exactly how it would work. I think it's one of those things that in theory people would go for, but actually in practice I don't think people would like it. And you know, you'd have to work out, and you know, there's not enough time, you know, in the year to do this, but how many matches actually contain frames where people play for snookers? I think these days with big breaks being made like they are, probably not that many actually. So I'm not sure it's a massive issue. I won't lie, again, you know, there are times when you think, oh, don't play on, you know, we don't need this. But is it? I don't think it's a massive issue. And like I say, there's a lot of skill involved. And also, as you say yourself, people do actually win frames having needed lots of snookers. Anthony McGill did in Belfast. In fact, Jimmy White did against McGill. So I'm inclined. I think if you sort of identify problems within snooker, the game itself is not one of them. The game should be basically left as it is, as far as I'm concerned. We move on. James Cook, you know, he's one of our American correspondents, one of our correspondents in America. He says, greetings from a cold and grey New York. It's been an embarrassment of riches for sport these last few weeks. Rugby World Cup, Cricket World Cup, Darts European Championship, and of course snooker, the English Open, Northern Ireland Open, Wuhan, and now the International Championship. At times have run out of screens and attention span to watch them all concurrently. Snooker's come in for quite a bit of bashing recently, Macau, scoreboards, etc. So I'm not going to add to the negativity. I myself have complained about the Matchroom live service, the only access I have to watching snooker here in the US, which is far from perfect. However, I've been able to watch all the tournaments 95% of the time with commentary. I recognise that in this streaming age, providing a live digital service is just table stakes, but it's still good to have access to it. In the spirit of being constructive, watching these aforementioned sports side by side sparks some thoughts on how the presentation of snooker could be enhanced. Number one, regarding the scoreboards, get a tech company to do them in return for a logo and some dollars. Provides more revenue, a stable scoring platform, a more respectable sponsorship partner. Well, I mean, on that, James, you know, they've obviously got the partner already, and I think we're all hopeful that the technical gremlins are going to be ironed out. You know, it works a lot of the time, but sometimes it breaks down. And when it breaks down in the arena, that's, I think, the real issue, because obviously it looks bad on telly then. But hopefully, you know, those issues have been ironed out. The second point from James, visualisations. The Cricket World Cup is full of them. I believe using Hawkeye Tech, ball tracking, bowling analysis, batter seat maps, etc., all add another dimension to the coverage. I realise there's more time in a cricket game to show this stuff, more relevance to show than in snooker. I'd be interested in a white ball heat map around the black after a big break, distance, white ball travel, etc. Again, this could be an opportunity for an AI-focused tech company to provide. I know snooker used Hawkeye in the past, and it's being used in the International Championship to good effect.
I mean, you mentioned the AI-focused tech company. You know, that already I'm shuddering at that. Because at Wimbledon this year, they actually produced small highlights packages with AI commentary. It wasn't actually a real commentator. It was just someone's voice that went through a computer. I mean, well, you dread to think, you know. I mean, the Beatles I think it's a number one single, which has come from an old John Lennon demo, which AI has sort of cleaned up so you can hear it, which you could argue that's using the technology for good. But what is to stop in the future, you know, you could take John Lennon's voice, run it through a computer, you've got a new album of John Lennon songs that, you know, have been literally put through a computer. He didn't write them, but his voice is on them. We're drifting off the point here, but anyway, in terms of your specific point, yeah, I'd like to see more of that. I think I was thinking that sort of thing. You're right, cricket, it lasts longer, it's on all day, so you can sort of tease them out over the course of the day. I think there's a danger sometimes with this stuff to overdo it and overcomplicate, particularly a game like snooker, which is chaotic a lot of the time. It's random, there's things happen, you get little nudges and bumps, and it's not all about sort of science. A lot of it is just sort of, and that's why we love it, a lot of it is just absolute chaos. But yeah, the ideas are good. James continues, I'm old enough to remember three UK TV channels, five or six tournaments a year, lower playing standards, and often patchy snooker coverage. So snooker is currently in a very good place, despite all the negativity. And yes, as an ex-PR person, if World Snooker Tour was my client, I'd be telling them to get out there with a forward-looking positive narrative. I would love to see it keep moving with the times and taking advantage of tech in partnership with tech companies to lend a more sophisticated edge to the coverage and potentially attract more viewers, players and revenue. That was quite a long email, so I'll stop there. Keep up the good work. The Snooker Scene podcast is still a highlight of the week and I enjoy your comms. Thank you, James. Very kind of you. Now, our final email before we get on to the Champion of Champions preview is from John, who says, on last week's episode, someone referred to a match between Alex Higgins and Cliff Thorburn at the 1982 Irish Masters at Goffs. Alex was 4-0 down at the interval, but came back to win 5-4. I was at the match with my dad. I was 14 at the time. I think the match was in the evening, but I did get the afternoon off school, so we must have attended the afternoon session as well. The second half of the Higgins-Thorburn match was tremendously exciting. After the match, I recall everyone in the crowd talking about how Higgins had gone to the bookies during the interval and placed a large amount on himself to win. People were saying it was £5,000 at big odds, as he was 5-0 down. I've no idea if the story is true, but I wouldn't be surprised. I noticed on Q-Tracker that his prize money for winning the match, a quarter-final, was only £1,875. He lost the semi-final to Steve Davis. The evening stands out in my memory for another reason. It was the day I stopped liking Alex Higgins. It was because of his behaviour towards people in the crowd during the match. I was seated near the front, and I recall him passing comments to audience members, probably not captured on camera. At the time, I thought it was nasty and quite menacing. I was surprised at it because the crowd were massively on his side. I was a big Steve Davis fan, but I liked Alex too, partly because he was Irish and partly because my dad had a cue signed by him. He'd won it in a raffle in his club in 1972 when Alex, who'd recently become world champion, was touring snooker halls in Ireland, giving exhibitions and playing locals. That cue, which was kept under the stairs in our house, was actually the first thing I ever knew about snooker. I think it was only about 2 months after that match against Thorburn that Higgins won the famous second world title. My enjoyment of that occasion was tempered by my memory of his behaviour at Goffs. Well, I will come to the rest of your email shortly, John, but it's interesting because, I mean, there are so many stories about Alex Higgins. You know, you could do every podcast on him. And a lot of people have positive memories of him, but an awful lot of negative ones. But there's still this sort of attitude that, oh, well, good old Alex, despite all that, because of his sort of flamboyance and his style and just the way he played, people tend to forgive him. But, you know, you clearly, your feelings about him were affected there. Clive, again, to go back to something Clive said about him, he said, they call Alex the people's champion, but what sort of people? And the answer to that is, a lot of his sort of natural audience were kind of, well, a lot of them I think were on the outside or on the fringes or saw themselves that way, that sort of have-nots really, who saw in him a hero who was going to kind of stick it to the man. He was anti-authority, he was anti-establishment. And I suppose if your lot in life is not what you wanted it to be, then someone like that is quite seductive, because you think, well, that's how I'd like to be. I'd like to sort of say to authority, yeah, you know, you can stick it, sort of thing. So he had a particular fan base. They weren't all like that, obviously. I mean, someone like Ken Doherty, he's nothing like that. And he remains a massive Alex Higgins fan, always has been. He was a very exciting player. I mean, there's no two ways about it. But equally, you know, some of his personal behaviour was lacking. I think, to be fair, though, you know, we're going back 40 years in these sort of more enlightened times, and I'm not making excuses, but in these more enlightened times, you know, there was no mental health discussion back then at all. Whereas now, I think people might sort of look at his more erratic behaviour and maybe consider sort of the reasons behind that and maybe some of the remedies for it. Back then, he was just a wild man, and that's how he was sort of cast, and that's the role that he was prepared to play. Anyway, John continues. On another note, some time back, you invited people to send in memories of the past 25 years of snooker, and I've been meaning ever since to send this in. The occasion in those 25 years when the importance of snooker struck me most strongly was during the final frame of the Corin Wilson-Anthony McGill semi-final at the World Championship in 2020. There'd been an unfortunate and significant falling out within the family, and my father and I hadn't spoken for many months. It was a difficult situation that I wasn't happy about. That summer afternoon, I was at home during COVID lockdown, watching that extraordinary final frame of the semi-final. My mobile phone rang. It was my dad. And he just said, "Are you watching it?" I said that I was. We stayed on the phone, talking throughout the rest of the frame. It broke the ice on a difficult period, and things were okay after that. Snooker has never meant as much to me as that day. Well, it's what a nice story that is, John. Thank you. And I'm glad all was well. And it just shows you, I think it's not just snooker. It's actually, I think, the World Championship more than anything. People, the reason, and this may, you know, be news to maybe some people who only look at it from a money perspective, but one of the reasons the Crucible has such a resonance with a certain people of a certain age anyway, is so many of us began watching that with family members. So when we think about the Crucible, we're not just thinking about snooker, we're thinking about ourselves when we were young, we're thinking about our families, the people we watched it with, what it meant to them, and maybe some of them are no longer with us. So it's not just a venue and a set of matches, it's actually memories of a lifetime and memories of, you know, where we were formed, who formed us, what they meant to us, how much we miss them. That is all part of it. And, you know, I think a lot of people see snooker as a kind of family sport in a way. And you've provided a perfect example there of why that is the case. So often you hear people talking about their memories of snooker are linked so much to their memories of their families. I mean, John Higgins, he started playing because his dad, John Senior, took him and his brother to a club, snooker club, ostensibly, you know, for something to do, but also he could have a drink with his pals, and John and his brother could play snooker. And that connection was made immediately. Steve Davis, obviously, with his dad Bill, you know, and a lot of the players of that era, they always, their dad always came with them. I'm glad that extraordinary frame between Corin and Anthony, you know, help bring about that coming together again. Thank you for the email. So anyway, we'll get to the champions shortly, but just on the UK Championship, the qualifiers start next weekend, and the last 4 days of the qualifiers it's been announced this week, will be available to watch on Discovery Plus as normal, but also on World Snooker Tour's YouTube and Facebook pages, so you can watch them for free on there. And I'm happy to say I'll be involved with some of the commentary. And we've got the Monday and Tuesday we'll be doing live commentary on the main table with competitions for tickets, and also hopefully good interaction with snooker fans around the world. And then the judgment days are Wednesday and Thursday. That's the final round of qualifying. Rob Walker will be presenting the studio coverage. And it went well last year. Obviously, Jimmy White was qualified, which is a great story, but the general drama, the new format, I think, has worked really well for the UK Championship. So we're all looking forward to bringing in that. And that will be, as I say, available on Discovery Plus, but also on World Snooker Tour's YouTube and Facebook pages.
So, to the Championship Champions, which is the big event coming up this week in Bolton. Now, it's celebrating its 10th anniversary. 2013, it was first introduced to the calendar. There was an old version of it in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, which ran for a few years. But this iteration was part of the Barry Hearn sort of takeover. Barry has just a great relationship with every broadcaster, and that includes ITV4, who had shown coverage, I think, earlier that year of the World Open in China, very early in the morning. And it had gone really well, and they identified snooker as a sport that they could add to their portfolio. And the Championship Champions was a great idea. It's a pretty simple idea in a way. It's the winners of all the tournaments, essentially. All play in the same event, and obviously if there aren't enough winners, then you top it up off the rankings. But they're all going to be winners this year. All the players in the tournament are going to be winners. So we're going to go through the draw. Now, obviously, there's a slight issue with Wednesday's play, because we don't know one of the players at the moment, or don't know for sure. So I'm going to slightly hedge that one, as you'll see when we get to it. But we'll start with Monday. Monday's group is really tough. We've got Mark Allen against Jimmy White, and Mark Selby against Ali Carter. Now, we start with Alan B. White. I think a year ago, most people would predict a heavy victory for Mark Allen, just because he was playing great at the time. Jimmy actually had a good season, but the problem Jimmy's got, I think, at the moment is that he doesn't play, unlike 30 years ago when it's second nature, he doesn't play that many TV matches. And what I've noticed in the last couple of years is when he plays one, he does seem nervous. And this is a big deal to be walking out there, one table, you know, back to where, as I say, he used to just be all the time. I think it's a big deal for him. Of course, Mark Allen now is the man with the experience of that. Having said that, you know, Allen's season has not been a good one compared to what he did last year. He did get to the quarterfinals in Wuhan, but other than that, it has been a bit of a struggle. And, well, does that mean there's an opportunity for Jimmy? I guess, you know, best of seven, there's always a chance. But the overall head-to-head favours Allen 4-1, so I think it would be a shock if Jimmy won. But certainly if he could win a couple of frames, maybe early on, then, as ever, for Jimmy White fans, there'd be a lot of excitement and a lot of hope that maybe he could do it. But obviously, Allen is going to be the favourite. The next match, though, is a very difficult one to call. Mark Selby and Ali Carter. Of course, Carter qualified by winning the German Masters last season. Mark Selby's actually qualified in three ways: the English Open and WSD Classic. He won. And also the World Championship runner-up gets in these days. But anyway, he got in through winning the English Open initially. Selby, of course, was in the last ITV final, the British Open. That's the first one he's ever been in. But he lost there to Mark Williams. And since then, really since that match with Martin O'Donnell, a couple of days later in Brentwood, he had to play twice in a day. And he conceded early, which for him is just, you know, unheard of. Didn't play Northern Ireland because he was due to play in those exhibitions. We won't go into that again. And then lost early on, of course, in... well, had already lost in Wuhan, lost early on at the International Championship to Tom Ford. So, really, you know, he's sort of not had the best of seasons, I suppose, by his standards. We're judging these people by very high standards. Ali Carter, runner-up in the Wuhan Open, and just got to the quarterfinals, the International Championship, where Ronnie O'Sullivan extended his record against him to 17-1. I mean, that's pretty brutal stuff. That's the biggest margin, you know, most one-sided head-to-head of any sort of matchup in the game at the moment, players on the tour now. And, you know, it's all-time, I think, is 17-0 Stephen Hendry, Terry Griffiths. So, you know, it's not far off that now. Anyway, he's not playing Ronnie O'Sullivan. He's playing Mark Selby. They've had some tough old matches down the years, these two. The overall head-to-head favours Selby 11-6, but, you know, Carter is one of these people, he fancies he's beaten anybody, actually, and he can beat anybody. It's just whether he can bring that form to Bolton. But I think that's a match you'd be brave to call. In terms of the overall group, I think Mark Allen will be in that group final. I know a lot of people say it's just a quarter final, but, I mean, you know, let's all get a life and not dwell on that too much. They play groups in a day, so we'll call it the group final. If we're going to say Mark Allen's in it, now he's played the first match, so if Selby Carter's a long match, there might not be too much of a gap before they play the second one. So despite not being in great form, maybe Mark Allen deserves to be the favourite there. I always think with Selby, though, you know, he's such a depressive player
such a great fighter, and maybe after a couple of sort of early exits from tournaments, you know, it may be a good time for him to start coming good. UK Championship around the corner as well. So if it's Selbin Allen in that match, then tough one to call, I think. But a great way to start the week, because I think that you could argue that's actually the toughest of all the groups. And, you know, it's always great. I know a lot of people still like to watch Jimmy White as well. Now, Tuesday, we've got Luca Brasel against Barry Hawkins and Mark Williams against Robert Milkins. So this is another terrific group, actually. Brasel, I already talked about earlier on, since that Shanghai final's been quite quiet, hasn't played and everything, seems to be a bit rusty compared to the other players, which, you know, he's going to be if he's not been playing. The Hawk is not. Barry Hawkins is certainly not rusty. He's having a great season. And we saw, again, just recently, quarter-finalist in the International Championship. Of course, he'd been semi-finalist in Belfast. He won the European Masters. So Barry Hawkins has been playing some terrific stuff this season, and it's good to see him back in the top 16 and back to his old self, really. Just a couple of meetings between them. The most recent was that European Masters last 16, which Hawkins won. So on the basis of this season, he's favourite. But I do get the feeling that, you know, Brasel, I think he's going to come good. We kind of saw it in Shanghai. That was just two tables. This is a one-table event. He might be in a tournament like this, you know, a big stakes tournament, where, you know, the real best shine. He beat Judd Trump there 1 year, 4-0 in no time at all. He can do that to people. So I kind of slightly fancy him to win it, even though he's got no real form to call on of late. And then the other match, Mark Williams, Robert Milkins, is 5-1 to Williams on the head-to-head. The last time he beat Milkins was in the World Championship that he most recently won, 2018. Milkins didn't play in the International Championship. He was one of the few top 16 players who didn't qualify. Mark Williams was beaten by Zhang Ande, who played very well indeed, 6-3 in the last 64. I just get the feeling there Williams might be a bit too sort of savvy in that match. He doesn't need always Mark to play his best to win matches. So it could well be Williams-Brasel. Of course, they played second round of the World Championship this year. Brasel won 13-11. That was a great match. Well, every match Brasel played was a great match, but that was maybe the first sign that he could actually potentially do something special there. And well, whoever's in the group final is going to be exciting, but perhaps I would go for Brasel Williams there. Wednesday is Ronnie O'Sullivan against TBC. Now, by the time you listen to this podcast, you may know who it is, but it's going to be dependent on what happens on Sunday in the International Championship final. If Ronnie O'Sullivan wins that tournament, then he will play Ding Junhui, the Six Reds world champion. And the next match is John Higgins against Chris Wakelin. But if Ronnie doesn't win the title, obviously either Tom Ford or Zhang Ande will have won it. As I record this, the O'Sullivan-Zhang Ande semi-final is not over yet. So if Zhang or Tom Ford won it, they'd be in the Champion of Champions. There may be a slight issue for O'Sullivan. I mean, he's won the Champion Championship four times. I think he's been runner-up twice. You know, it's a tournament that he kind of owns, really. It's perfect for him. It's a one-table event where you only actually have to play 3 days. That's the other thing of the seven that it is. So he's not having to pitch up every day. But I guess the slight issue this year, potentially, is just the turnaround from China. And also, there's no doubt this tennis elbow is a real thing, and if it has been troubling him, you know, he may want to rest it. He's not got a lot of time to do that. He'll be flying home, I guess, Monday. He'd be in Bolton Tuesday night to play Wednesday, so there's not a lot of time. So maybe the schedule may catch him out, because, of course, in years gone by, quite often he would skip the Chinese events. So even if they were sort of close to Champion of Champions, often he hadn't played in them. But that's changed now, so could his sort of devotion to China perhaps imperil, you know, doing well in that event? You never know with him, obviously, but that's something, I think, to look out for. And this is why I slightly fancy John Higgins in this group, actually. Chris Wakelin, of course, is having a great time of it. He's just been runner-up in the Northern Ireland Open, won the shootout earlier this year, which he got in the event. But coming out to play an event like this, a one-table, you know, big prestige elite field tournament, he's kind of new to him, so it'll be interesting to see how he adapts to that, because he's not got long to. It's the best of seven. John Higgins, obviously, he's more than used to that in his career. He played many of these sort of tournaments. Indeed, he's won this one, the Champion of Champions. So for that reason, I kind of favour him. And then if there is a bit of tiredness, let's say O'Sullivan does win the first match. We don't know whether he will or not. It could be that El Clasico goes to Higgins. So just, I mean, these are just wild predictions. That's all they are. But it's an interesting group, as indeed is Thursday. Now, Thursday, Judd Trump, of course, he's up against the women's world champion. That's Bipat Siripaporn. And, of course, that's going to be a massive match for her. And then it's Gary Wilson against Sean Murphy. Trump, you know, he's going to win that match, I suspect. I don't think that's a, you know, out of order, just making that prediction. There's a massive gulf in ability. But obviously, it's an opportunity for women's snooker again to get a platform. Remind everybody that there is a women's game, although also that women can play on the main tour. It's not a men's circuit, it's a professional circuit, albeit one that's historically been heavily dominated by men. But good luck to her. It's a very tough draw. Whoever she drew would be tough, but to run into Trump, who's won three tournaments in a row, that's difficult. And then Sean Murphy, Gary Wilson, well, hard one to call, I think. Gary, I thought, played really well in Tianjin, the International Championship. Ran ding all the way, 6-5. Could have gone either way. And Sean made a good start to the season, won the Championship League. Obviously, since then, all this Q business has sort of been the sort of focus of chat around him. It's too early to judge, you know, whether that experiment is going to work or not. It's only been going a couple of tournaments. But it seems that he's just lost a little bit of form. And that can happen, you know. It came off the back of last season playing really well. He's played well in matches he's lost. I mean, the Jack Lazowski one at the British Open is an obvious example. So it's not always that he's not played well, but it's just getting the wins, I suppose. All things being equal, well, Trump, I think, is going to win that group, personally. I just think he's playing so well at the moment. Obviously, he's runner-up to Ronnie last year in the tournament. Likes the tournament. Won it the year before himself. So all of that leaves us with Judd Trump, John Higgins, Luca Brasel, and I can't remember who I went for on the first day. Was it Mark Allen or Mark Selby? One of those two. Basically, they're all going to be big hitters in the semi-finals. In terms of who's going to win the tournament, well, I don't know. I mean, I do have a slight feeling for Brasel. I don't know why, really, because he's done not much this season and he seems to have lost a bit of an edge compared to the other players. But we know that he thrives on inspiration. Also, I've written a piece about him in the programme. So I've got to sort of back myself for that. Yes, if you're in Bolton, you can read my piece about him. I'd like to see him come good again this season. I think we need our world champion to be visible and doing well because it helps the whole sport gain a platform. So hopefully, you know, Luca will find something at some point, maybe this week. Either way, it's going to be a really good week. It always is a terrific tournament. I think it's got actually a perfect format. You get the two best of sevens in the afternoon and then one best of 11 at night, which means it's not going to be too late to finish. There's not too much snooker at night. It's not one of these midnight jobs. It's just about right. Very good format, very good tournament. And of course, they'll be wearing distinctive shirts. That the clothing has sort of moved on a bit, and you can actually buy now the shirts that the players are wearing. So if you've got a favourite player, say you're a big, Ronnie O'Sullivan fan, you can buy a Rocket t-shirt that he will wear in the match. So that's kind of an interesting development. I know a lot of people, traditionalists, want to keep the traditional formal wear, the bow ties and the waistcoats, but I also think that people accept that in certain events there's room for experiment and change, and that's what's happening. It's a Matchroom run event. They like to innovate, and it's going to be good. And I think ticket sales, I'm told, are good in Bolton, so looking forward to it. It's live on ITV4 in the UK, and other broadcasters will be taking it. Check the website for details. Well, that's it for this week. So do keep your UK Championship memories coming in. Any specific memories of that tournament, we'll celebrate it nearer the time. And it's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's the address for any questions or observations you may have.
So that's it, really. I'm off for a lime cordial. in the meantime, as we always say, thanks for listening and goodbye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.